We know it was on the 23rd of February, but there's some doubt of the year. It's sometime between 155 AD and 160 AD when Polycarp of Smyrna, a place that's in modern-day Turkey, a very old man, at least 80 years of age, was brought before an unruly mob by a proconsul to be burnt to death as a Christian martyr. The test questions were put to him, standard questions. Curse Christ, and I will release you. Swear by the genius of the emperor, change your mind and say away with the atheists. It was a general accusation against Christians at that time that they were atheists, because they didn't worship the Roman gods, nor did they have any icons or statues or idols of their own gods. Polycarp looked around at the pagan crowd around about him, gathered to bay for his blood, and then raising his eyes to heaven, he waved his hand at them and said, "Away with the atheists." Idols were all over the ancient world, but they were no part of the Bible-believing Christian world. So distinctive was this lack of idols in Christianity that Christians were then for many centuries accused of being without gods, atheists. Remember how the Apostle Paul, when he was accused in Ephesus of damaging Demetrius's, the silversmith's, business, remember how he got taken into a riot because of it? You see, when people came to Christ, they gave up their idolatry, creating an economic downturn for idol makers, for silversmiths. How different today, when Christian bookshops are kept alive financially by the religious bric-a-brac they sell, crosses and crucifixes and necklaces and rings. Demetrius should have just hung around for a millennium or two, and he could have made a killing on the markets amongst Christians. Well, this first talk on idols is going to go along three headings here. The Ten Commandments, what is an idol and what's wrong with idols, is what we'll cover between here and afternoon tea, and we'll be looking at the subject of the eyes after afternoon tea. The rejection of idols didn't start with the New Testament. It's found in the Ten Commandments, in the Old Testament, of course, the Ten Commandments given by God to Moses on Mount Sinai, or sometimes it's called Mount Horeb. The first commandment insists that Israel is to have no other gods. No other gods but Yahweh. We're going to have our Bible readings from time to time from Marley, who's popping up and reading here from time to time, a change in voice as we go. And so we're going to be reading from Exodus 20, verse 1. You won't have time to get there by the time she's finished reading it.
And God spoke all these words, saying, "I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery."
You shall have no other gods before me, is God's word. See, there's only one God, the creator of heaven and earth, the creator of all humanity, the creator of all nations. Other nations didn't know and or rejected God, making up their own gods and worshipping things that were not God. But for Israel, there was no other gods before me. The one true living God who revealed himself to Israel, rescuing them from slavery in Egypt, meeting them at Mount Sinai, inviting them to be his people, living his way in his land, offering to be their God, married to them by covenant and contract. The Ten Commandments are the beginning of that contract, that marriage contract. The first commandment, you see, insists on monogamy. You shall have no other gods before me. The second commandment is different. It insists that there is to be no idols.
You shall not make for yourself a carved image or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above, or that is in the earth beneath, or that is in the water under the earth. You shall not bow down to them or serve them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children to the third and the fourth generation of those who hate me, but showing steadfast love to thousands of those who love me and keep my commandments.
Sadly, though, understandably, people confuse these first two commandments. And the Roman Catholic Church doesn't confuse them, it combines them into one commandment, making the number 10 by dividing up the last commandment into two. But today, many Protestants are confusing these first two commandments, for they don't take seriously enough the topic of this afternoon, the reality of idolatry. Notice three details of the commandment. Firstly, there is to be no making of idols, no images of anything in heaven or in earth or in the water, no images of birds or fish or animals or humans, no images to be made. It's more than you are not to worship idols, you're not even to make them. You're not to make for yourself what you think of God. That is, you do not determine what God is like or to what you can liken God. He alone determines what he is like and how he is to be worshipped. Secondly, notice there's no bowing down to them, to idols, to serve them. They're never to be treated like your masters or your God. There's to be no bowing down in obeisance to them, paying homage and veneration as you would to a God. No serving of them as if that you were their servants and they were your lords and masters. If you haven't made them, you certainly can't bow down to them. But this sentence makes it clear that what we're talking about is idols for worship and not statues per se. He's not saying no statues are ever to be made anywhere under any circumstance of any person. You are entitled to make a statue of whichever your favourite politician is. Which generally keeps you from making statues, doesn't it? But you're not to make the kind of statue that people bow down to. You're not to make them. And you mustn't use that, of course, that you can build a statue as an excuse for owning them. You know, I didn't make it, so it's not, you know, it's not my fault. I bought it at a market. I don't bow down to them. It's just that I like the artistry. They look pretty. God's people are to have nothing to do with idols. The idols that other people may bow down to and serve as their gods, we are never to have anything to do with them. You see, the Second Council of Nicaea, which is something you all know about, I'm sure, it occurred in 787 AD, I wasn't there at the time, said, we must have idols in our churches, but not to worship them, though we must revere them and venerate them. Well, that's a Pharisaic distinction without a difference, isn't it? The commandment says, do not make them, do not bow down to them, do not serve them. In other words, have nothing to do with them. And thirdly, notice from this commandment, God's jealousy. For God is a husband to Israel who loves his bride and will not share his bride with another. So he is jealous when she commits adultery, either with foreign gods, breaking the first commandment, or with a false vision of God, breaking the second commandment. To make and bow down to idols is iniquity. And most people today find it hard to see idolatry as iniquity. Superstitious, silly, non-Christian, unbiblical, but iniquity? In part, it's because we have a rule-based morality instead of the Bible's relationship-based morality. For us, it's iniquity when it breaks some rule. Well, this is the Ten Commandments. That's a pretty important one to break. But the Bible is much more important that we are living in rebellion against God. To make an image of God for worship is to reject God, is to distort God, is to rebel against God, is to hate God. Thus, it's sin, it's iniquity, and it won't go unpunished. But already in this discussion, you can hear the confusion about idols and gods. So let's address the question, what is an idol? I mean, the answer at one level is very simple and obvious. I mean, the basic Oxford Dictionary definition of an idol is perfectly correct and adequate: an image or representation of a god used as an object of worship. It's fairly straightforward. There's nothing difficult in understanding what the concept is and the word means. And the ancient world was full of idols, and still around the world today, idols abound, statues and images of all manner of things on earth or in heaven or in the seas. I was in Malaysia last year, and around the corner from where I was staying was a Hindu temple, and it was just like that. Idols went up and up and the outside of thousands of idols on just one temple, and there are thousands of temples throughout the world. Idolatry is very common, very widespread, quite normal in our world. But I want to contend to you that there are two forms of idolatry that are mentioned in the Bible. There is the true worship of false gods and the false worship of the true God. Quite different, those two things. You see, the true worship of the false gods is the representation of the gods of human imagination in the statues and images that are made in order to be bowed down and worshipped. But the false worship of the true God is the artistic representation of Yahweh in some image or statue that people use as aids to worship. This is seen classically in the golden calf episode in Exodus chapter 32. Moses was up in the mountain and the people were committing adultery on their wedding night. You see what's called iniquity? You think about it. Adultery during a wedding reception. Pretty hard to justify that as anything other than iniquitous and wicked in extreme. But that was the adultery that they were involved in. For they were adulterously worshipping the golden calf while God was giving the marriage certificate in the Ten Commandments written on stone. And so in Exodus 32, verses 4 to 5, we read, "And he, Aaron, that is, received the gold from their hand and fashioned it with a graving tool and made a golden calf. And they said, 'These are your gods, O Israel, who brought you up out of the land of Egypt.' When Aaron saw this, he built an altar before it, and Aaron made a proclamation and said, 'Tomorrow shall be a feast to the Lord,'" that is, to Yahweh in capital letters, because the Hebrew word there is the name of God, Yahweh. Do you see it? They weren't worshipping other gods. The golden calf was a representation of the gods who brought them out of Egypt. Well, who were the gods who brought them out of Egypt? Why, it was Yahweh was the God who brought them out of Egypt. But they weren't even yet clear in their understanding of Yahweh. They weren't clear that Yahweh is one and that there is only one God who brought them out of Egypt. And so they make this calf to represent whatever gods brought us out of the land of Egypt. But notice what the celebration is. Aaron, who knew a little better, who knew the name, Aaron says, saw this and he built an altar before it, and Aaron made a proclamation. He said, "Tomorrow shall be a feast to Yahweh." The golden calf was representing Yahweh. You see how this is the false representation of the true God. That is idolatry, as much as making true representations of false gods. This is the false worship of the true God, for Yahweh is not many but one, and Yahweh is not a bull, the symbol of fertility and strength and inarticulate stupidity. The Yahweh is not gold, he's not silver. And the history of Israel from that time onwards was riddled with the worship of idols, not just of other gods, but of the idolatrous worship of the true and living God, serving and trusting in things instead of trusting in God himself. For anything can become an idol, but nothing can truly represent Yahweh, the creator of God of Israel who rules the world. There's nothing that you can have in this world that will represent him. See, even good things can be turned into idols. So the serpent made by Moses in the wilderness that the people looked to and were saved That serpent had to be destroyed in Hezekiah's day because people were worshipping the serpent on the staff. And the temple, the great temple made by Solomon, God's house, the temple had to be destroyed in Jeremiah's day because people trusted in the temple instead of trusting in Yahweh. They said, oh, the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord, we'll be safe. The Babylonians will never come here. They'll never conquer us. We've got the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord. Woe that they had the Lord. The temple wasn't going to save them. The Lord was the only one who would save them. But there are two common confusions about idols. Firstly, the confusion with gods. I mean, this confusion is the confusion of the first two commandments. The idols frequently represented other gods, and so after a while, the language, they've got idols, they've got gods, it was synonymous. But the concept of other gods is different to the concept of making images of the other gods. Commandment one, you're not to have the other gods. Commandment two, you're not to make images. They're two different things. You see this problem in this very popular book that's around, Tim Keller's book, Counterfeit Gods. It's rightly titled Counterfeit Gods. But while that is the title of the book, it keeps dropping into the language of idolatry in order to speak of the idols of our heart. Consequently, in the opening chapter alone, there are multiple definitions of idolatry, none of which are about statues. All are actually definitions about gods and our service and creation of other gods. It's wrong to serve other gods. It's a book about the first commandment, but it keeps on confusing it with the second commandment. Which leads me to the second confusion, the confusion with the metaphor. Occasionally, the Bible uses idolatry metaphorically. Covetousness, which is idolatry, in Colossians chapter 3, verse 5. Now, metaphors are powerful ways of drawing something to your attention. Idolatry is adultery in Ezekiel 23:37. It's not literally adultery, but calling it adultery heightens the horror for those who are committed to marriage. Adultery for those committed to marriage is an appalling thing. To hear that idolatry is adultery puts idolatry in a really appalling bracket. That's the same with covetousness, is idolatry of Colossians 3:5. It heightens the horror of greed and covetousness, which we just take for granted, because it puts it in the same category as idolatry, which is the great sin of Israel. Some people, though, today take this metaphor of idolatry too far, ignoring the reality of idolatry, which is about artistic representations of God. See, when everything is idolatry, nothing is idolatry. It undermines the very real problem of idolatry in our world today. It undermines the reality of sin as rebellion against God. And spiritually, it psychologizes the nature of sin. Artistic representations of God and the use of statues, relics, charms, art to relate to God is a real ongoing 21st century problem. Some of us here have grown up in homes, and becoming Christians has been turning away from the family idolatry, even defying our families and cultural traditions in order to acknowledge Christ. Others may have been attracted to the rank stupidities of the New Age movement with their spells and charms and crystals and candles, all of which are supposed to promote health and well-being and all kinds of bizarre things. If you really want to have an entertaining day, go and find out what a crystal can do for you. It is extraordinary the things that crystals can do for you. To say nothing of candles and aromatherapies and the like. Many of us, though, have grown up in churches which approach God, bowing and genuflecting to all manner of idols and icons as aids to worship, smells and bells and beads and bracelets and crosses and crucifixes and endless candle lighting. Oh God, he doesn't know anything about electricity. There's no reason for, and there's every reason against, building churches with pointy windows, stained glass windows, which effectively block out the light with their religious pictures and block up the spaces with statues. The idea that a church has a particular architecture of a medieval character is an abomination. And yet, it's not a real church we're in at the moment, is it? Because it looks so plain. So I like Moore College. It's a beautiful lecture theatre. Don't get me wrong. Just say, I thank you for your invitation to continue sharing here. But it doesn't look religious, does it? You can't look religious without being idolatrous. Looking religious is idolatry. The commandment is quite clear. Don't make images. Don't bow down to them. Don't serve them. But the commandments of God are not arbitrary whims, but express his mind and his character. So what are the reasons for banning images and icons? What's wrong with idols? It's not that God hates beauty. Remember, in the garden, he made the trees pleasant for sight as well as good for food. Furthermore, the commandment against idols is more than rejecting other gods. It's more than rejecting syncretistic mixing up of the gods. That's what's rejected in the first commandment. The second commandment is against visual representations of God and their use in worship. Now, why? I want to give you five quick reasons as to why idolatry is so wrong. Firstly, foolishness. Several times in the prophets, they ridicule idolatry as foolish. Isaiah 44 is one of those ones, which Marley's going to read for us now from verse 15 to 17.
Then it becomes fuel for a man. He takes a part of it and warms himself. He kindles a fire and bakes bread. Also, he makes a god and worships it. He makes an idol and falls down before it. Half of it he burns in the fire. Over the half he eats meat. He roasts it and is satisfied. Also, he warms himself and says, "Aha, I am warm, I have seen the fire." And the rest of it he makes into a god, his idol, and he falls down to it and worships it. He prays to it and says, "Deliver me, for you are my God."
The thing is fundamentally stupid, isn't it, to be worshipping a lump of wood? But Romans chapter 1 also calls idolatry foolishness. From verse 18, when we hear of the wrath of God coming upon the superstitious silliness of humanity, from verse 21, we read this way.
For although they knew God, they did not honour him as God or give thanks to him, but they became futile in their thinking, and their foolish hearts were darkened. Claiming to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images resembling mortal man and birds and animals and creeping things.
So the first reason against idolatry is just the sheer crass foolishness of making something up that you are going to now worship. It is ridiculous, isn't it? In AA, you have to express firstly that you are an alcoholic, and then secondly, a belief in a higher power. But what that higher power is, you can choose. And so my friends from AA tell me of some of the things that people choose to have as their higher power who is going to help them out of their alcoholism. The sea. How's the sea going to help me out of my alcoholism? The mountains. How will a mountain help me? I may as well go down to the New Age shop and buy a crystal. But you see, the foolishness of idolatry knows no end. The second reason is of why idolatry is so wrong is its misrepresentation. For all images, instead of representing God, actually misrepresent him. We see this when Psalm 115 is sending up the nation's idols in contrast to Yahweh. The idols don't represent anything like Yahweh. They represent gods that aren't worth serving. So if you'll read that for us, Marley, from, say, verses 3 to 7.
Our God is in the heavens. He does all that he pleases. Their idols are silver and gold, the work of human hands. They have mouths, but do not speak, eyes, but do not see. They have ears, but do not hear, noses, but do not smell. They have hands, but do not feel, feet, but do not walk, and they do not make a sound in their throat.
This is always the problem with idolatry. Idols, they're dead, they're mute, they're powerless, they're blind, they're deaf. They don't think, they don't move unless you move them. They don't hear, they don't understand. They're everything that God is not, and nothing that God is. So they are always a misrepresentation of God. The dog knows what to do with an idol when he lifts his leg on it. And the bird knows what to do when they drop upon it. Because the idol cannot do anything. They are dead, dumb, lifeless. And yet people wish to give their lives to them. It's foolishness, but it's also misrepresenting the Almighty. Third, as a misrepresentation, idols are used by demons. For the devil is a liar and the father of all lies. And you can't lie much more than to misrepresent God by a statue. So in 1 Corinthians chapters 8 to 11, there's a long three chapters on the subject of idolatry. Paul can point out that the gods that the idols represent don't exist. But in reviewing the Exodus events and the way Israel was led astray to idols, he commands, "Therefore, my beloved, flee from idolatry." There is no God that these idols are representing, so what's the problem? Flee from idolatry, he says. And his reason for this command is because idolatry is participation in with demons. For as he points out in chapter 12, when the Corinthians were pagans, they were led astray in their spirituality to mute idols. Anything that can get people to give themselves to such lies, such stupidities, such vacuous thinking has got to come from the evil one who is the father of all lies. And so the fourth reason against idolatry is God's revelation. We are not to make up God in the terms that we want him to be. We're not to say, oh, I like to think of God as, or I can't believe a God would. We have to accept God as he is, and so accept God in whatever way he reveals himself to be. Moses makes this very clear in Deuteronomy 4. I'd encourage you to look up this passage because it's a little bit longer than we're going to be reading this time. In Deuteronomy 4, when he recounts Israel meeting with God at Mount Horeb, when they were given the law on that great occasion. So we're going to read from Deuteronomy 4, verse 12, through to around about verse 19.
Then the Lord spoke to you out of the midst of the fire. You heard the sound of words, but saw no form. There was only a voice. And he declared to you his covenant, which he commanded you to perform, that is, the Ten Commandments. And he wrote them on two tablets of stone. And the Lord commanded me at that time to teach you statutes and rules, that you might do them in the land you are going over to possess. Therefore, watch yourselves very carefully. Since you saw no form on the day that the Lord spoke to you at Horeb out of the midst of the fire, beware lest you act corruptly by making a carved image for yourselves in the form of any figure, the likeness of male or female, the likeness of any animal that is on the earth, the likeness of any winged bird that flies in the air, the likeness of anything that creeps on the ground, the likeness of any fish that is in the water under the earth. And beware lest you raise your eyes to heaven, and when you see the sun and the moon and the stars, all the host of heaven, you be drawn away and bow down to them and serve them, things that the Lord your God has allotted to all the peoples under the whole heaven.
Some of the most sophisticated newspapers published in Australia today have astrology columns. The astrologers don't even have the stars in the right place in the skies. It is utterly stupid. But yet, a large percentage of our population read them regularly, and some 20% say they take action on behalf of them, on the basis of their advice. That's astonishing. But that is the character of the gods that people will make for themselves, looking up to the stars, looking up to the heavens, making statues of this, of birds, of flies. God's words are to be obeyed, for he spoke and he commanded, but he didn't appear before their eyes. He is to be worshipped by obedience, not by bowing down to images. Indeed, the Hebrew word for obedience is the verb to hear. There is no separate word for hearing and obeying. It's the same word. And the daily confession of Israel is found just two chapters later in Deuteronomy 6.
Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your might. And these words that I command you today shall be on your heart. You shall teach them diligently to your children and shall talk of them when you sit in your house and when you walk by the way and when you lie down and when you rise.
You don't see God, but you hear God. And what you hear of God, you are to teach to your children and your children's children. And you must always remember that opening command. Every day it was said, the Shema, hear, O Israel. It's not look, O Israel. It's hear, O Israel, for that is how we met God, in his speaking to us. God's choice to reveal himself, not by sight, but by word, that his people may understand and obey. For as we'll see in the second session this afternoon, visualization does not teach you to understand, and it does not teach you to obey. But there's a fifth reason why we must not have idols. That is God's image. For when God made the world, we read in Genesis 1, verses 26 to 27.
Then God said, "Let us make man in our image, after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the heavens, and over the livestock, and over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth." So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them.
Humanity was created to image God in this world. We are the image of God. We are God's image of God. When God wanted to make an image of God, he made us. He made humanity. For like him, we speak. We hear, we see, we live. Like him, we are powerful and in dominion over everything else. We talk, we rule, we love, we promise, we can control, and we are just and we are faithful. Though some of us have seriously failed in our godlike characters. And even though we've seriously failed, we're still infinitely more like God than any statue or any picture. In fact, we're even greater than our best pictures of ourselves. Give me a fine picture of my wife, or give me my wife. I'm not going for the picture, you can keep it. She is infinitely better than the best picture you may ever come up with. We are the image of God. And even though we've failed, we still are. But we haven't all failed, because there was one man who indeed was the perfect image of God, namely God's own Son, the Lord Jesus Christ. And so we read of Jesus, God's Son, in Colossians chapter 1, verse 15. He is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn, the heir of all creation. He bears the very stamp and imprint of God's nature. He was the one through whom, by whom, and for whom the whole world, including you and me, well, the whole world was made. This isn't talking of the pictures of Jesus. We've got no idea what Jesus looked like. I know your Bibles or your children's Bibles all have pictures of Jesus, and he always looks the same, doesn't he? Well, he's not. We've got no idea. He's short. I think he looked Jewish. But what does Jewish look like? Well, we don't know that either, do we? We do not know. There is nothing said about the physical appearance of Jesus. No descriptions, because that was not what was important about him. What was important about him was that he was the very image of God. He is the perfectly obedient son of his father. He is the one who, and the only one, who could bear the sins of the world. He is the one who has risen from the dead to rule the world, King of kings, Lord of lords, as God incarnate. Therefore, all idolatry is a rejection of God. All idolatry is a rejection of humanity as the image of God. And all idolatry is a rejection of the Lord Jesus Christ, the true image of the invisible God. God's Son, who became human to rescue us, is rejected when people make any statues, images of him or of his Father. So becoming a Christian in the New Testament always involves rejecting idolatry and idols. The Thessalonians, what was said, you see, they turned from idols to serve the true and living God and wait for his Son from heaven, Jesus, who rescues us from the wrath to come. Leaving idolatry to turn to God was fundamental to Christianity. And that is why, at the time of Polycarp, Christians didn't have any idols. And the non-Christian looking on in a world full of idolatry says, "Don't you have gods? Why don't you have gods? Where is the statue of your God? How come I come into your house and I look around and there's no altar to these gods? There's no gods. Are you an atheist?" Jesus held the coin in his hand with the image, with the icon of Caesar on it. And he asked the question, whose image is this? Whose icon is this? Whose idol is this? Same language. And they told him, it's Caesar's. And so he said, give to Caesar what is Caesar's. They have Caesar's image on them. They're Caesar's. Give them to him. And then he says the other part, doesn't he? And give to God the things that are God's. Give to God whatever has the image of God upon it. For we are created in the image of God. And we are to give ourselves to God. For we have God's stamp all over us as humans, creatures, made to be his image.